Hi there, welcome to Halos of Home, Radio Mariam podcast. I'm Serena, and on our fourth episode, we have the beautiful Beatrice. Can you introduce yourself for us very quickly?
Of course I can. Hi, I'm Beatrice. I am a volunteer with Birthright Armenia right now. I'm originally from Beloit, Wisconsin, and I've been in Armenia for a good amount of months at this point, but I'm actually headed out of Armenia in the next week. So I'm very excited to talk about home as someone who is changing locations. My career is in the sciences. I am a landscape ecologist and community ecologist, and I am now going on to pursue a PhD in ecology and remote sensing, and I'm excited to be here today.
Yay! Thanks, Beatrice.
Of course.
The first question I want to ask you relates to your background in science. I'm wondering, how does science inform your idea of home? If it does. Because you're very informed about science, so I'm sure it would play into how you conceive your idea of home.
That's a wonderful question.
Yeah.
So my background in science is not as much medicine, chemistry, anything like that related. It's more looking at ecosystems and ecosystem health. And I think that that really has informed how I view home, because you look at species relationships, you look at relationships with landscape, you look at relationships in certain areas of the world, and you can't help but see interpersonal relationships, country relationships, like how you and your parents get along, how you interact with a community. I mean, the field that I studied a lot in college was called community ecology. You're looking at species, but you can so easily superimpose that onto people and life, and it's a fun way to sort of see connections.
That's so cool. Can you tell us more about community ecology?
Yeah, I can. Community ecology is a really interesting subject related to biodiversity and related to how species interact with each other. So you take any sort of ecosystem you're familiar with. You have plants, you have animals that eat the animals, and then you have the landscape that they live in. What's the temperature? How are the non-living factors, water, everything? The way that all of these things interact make oftentimes absolutely unique ecosystems. So I wasn't looking at it from a people perspective in college. I was looking at it mostly in a place that is not my home, in sub-Saharan Africa in the Congo Basin. But you can so easily look at your own community. I mean, I'm from a very small rural farming community in southern Wisconsin. And you can't find all of those ingredients, those interactions, anywhere else. And the fantastic thing about community ecology is that it is so special. It really scares scientists, because then you realize, okay, if I take one piece out of this puzzle, you can't see the picture anymore. And all of the other species go crazy, because suddenly all of these chains are broken. So it makes you look at sort of the connectivity of your community and also the world.
I have two follow-up questions on that. Yes. So is it the uniqueness about the ecosystem, or I guess if you apply that to humanity, the uniqueness of certain environments that make it a home? That's question one. And the second one is the precariousness of environments. Does that make it a home?
I think that's a very good observation to make. I think they both do, right? It's such a unique place. You're able to replicate certain things. I mean, you think about, if you miss something from home and you're in another place, you can go to the grocery store, you can make a meal you make at home, you can call people, you can find a community, maybe a church or some other scientific community, book club, whatever that you did at home,
yeah.
But you'll never have all of those aspects of home in the exact same way that you had when you grew up.
Mm.
And similarly, the precariousness, I think about it with my grandparents. They are never going to be home again. My mom's side of the family, my grandpa grew up in Aleppo. His house isn't there anymore. His community isn't there anymore.
Mm.
But he's been able to make a new home and like a proxy home in a different place. But you'll never have that sort of unique level again. That's why scientists are really freaked out about climate change, about sort of forest destruction. I mean, if you destroy a place, building a place up again, restoring a place, is so hard, because there are all of those really tiny details that you usually overlook wherever you are home. And then when you're somewhere that you don't consider home, you look back and you say, oh, I miss this tiny thing that I'll never be able to replicate.
So everyone has an original home that they lose through time and through life, do you think?
It depends. For me, definitely, I think that that's the case. I don't see myself ever moving back to the Midwest and being in the same place that I grew up in, and I consider that my home.
You would never move back there. Why?
I think career-wise, life-wise, I think that people, as they grow up and as they develop and explore, they get all of these different homes, right? Mm. So I have a home in Boston where I went to college. And when I go home to Wisconsin, then I think, oh, there are all of these things in Boston, these little pieces of the ecosystem that I don't have.
Mm.
Now in Armenia,
mm.
I'll be back home and I'll think, oh, I can't have this food anymore. I can't go speak Armenian out on the street anymore.
Mm.
So it's like you're leaving little pieces of yourself in all of these different homes as you mm. grow and develop and move through life. Everyone has many homes and no homes at the same time. That's the way that I would view it for myself. But you can come really close and you can sort of be at peace with that and realize, oh, wow, I've lived such a wonderful life that I have all of these different homes and I've had all these different experiences. There is a moment in time where that home existed for you and then sometimes mm. it leaves.
How can that make you a fuller person rather than making you feel more divided?
That's a good question. Sometimes I feel really divided. Yeah. Like, I don't know about when you moved here, but I had crazy homesickness. And now I know when I go back, I'll have... Have you ever heard
the
of
reverse, culture shock?
Or, yes. Yeah. There's this curve. I read it on a travel blog when I was like, how to fix my homesickness. Where initially you're in the honeymoon phase with a place.
Yeah.
You crash down really low. You're like, this place is not my home. This place has all of these things that I don't like.
When is that? 4 week stage normally?
Like, if you're moving somewhere, I think it's more like a month and a half, 2 months. But I think it hits people differently. And then you slowly build back up to a normal level again. And then it dips back down when you go home. Originally, when you get home, it goes way up. You're like, oh, I'm back at the place that I left. This is so great. And then you realize all of the things that it doesn't have that the other place did have. What was the original question?
About how you can look at that with the perspective of I'm actually a fuller, more rounded person rather than feeling fragmentary.
Yeah. Yes. So I think we leave little pieces of us everywhere, but we pick up things too. So you change fundamentally as a person every place that you go that you consider home, every new home that you get. And you take a little bit of that home with you and you leave a little bit of your old self behind. So I don't know about you, but I definitely feel like I've left a little, I'm going to leave a little bit of my soul here and I'm going to take a little bit of something new back. And I mean, the other nice thing about home that you can't do in an ecosystem in biology, but you can do as a person, is you can remember all of these wonderful things and sort of think about all of these wonderful things.
And you leave parts of yourself behind in the relationships that you make. It's like you're planting seeds of your personality into every single encounter you have.
Yeah.
And that's unique to humans too.
Well, I don't know about that. I think a lot of animals and plants and different places do that, but...
In a relational sense, or in what sense?
In a relational sense, yes, or in like an ecosystem memory sense. I don't know if you know about seed banks.
I am the least informed person about science.
That's
so
okay.
This is great.
So imagine you have a forest. It's a home, right? Home for so many different birds and species, whatever. And then someone comes in and clears the forest.
Yeah.
And they do farmland or something. They do farming there for a really long time. And then they move on. And they just leave this farmland behind. The trees have left behind all of the seeds of way before they were cleared in the ground. Mm-hmm. And given the right sort of situation or maybe some sort of movement or change, all of these things are going to start growing back again. That sort of relational memory, that sort of historical memory does exist in ecosystems. And the same goes for like dispersal. I'm thinking about it with seeds because I'm not a big animal gal, I'm more of a tree person. But imagine the wind takes a seed somewhere. It's going to forever now give the memory of that tree to a new ecosystem. And it's sort of spreading different species and different ecosystem memories to a different place. It can be bad with invasives, right?
Yeah.
But it can also be really good if there's a place that was cleared for farmland and then suddenly you have a seed bank and you have all of these seeds coming in. A new forest, given enough time and healing, can grow. It won't be exactly the same, but it can still grow into something new.
That point that you made about trees. Okay, I was reading Job recently. Just the connection is Job looks at trees and he says that when a tree dies, it sprouts the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And he compares that to humanity and says how humans are without hope because when we die, that's it. We're not coming back to life. I don't know. That just reminded me of somehow what you were saying.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Does that relate to home in any way, the human experience being different from the ecological experience? What would you draw from that?
Yeah. I mean, I have a book recommendation. I'm a big ecological reading fan right now. There's this book called Immense World by Ed Yong, and it's all about how we experience the world and how other organisms experience the world, and how we like to say, okay, dogs, for example. Mm. Dogs experience the world a lot like us. They see things similarly, they hear things similarly, they probably feel things similarly to us. Ed Yong says, okay, well, maybe that's not the case. Maybe they just have such a different experience of the world to us that we just can't get it sometimes. Then he tries to help you get it. He's like, okay, their eyesight is horrible compared to people's eyesight sometimes. But hearing, they just have so many different experiences that we just can't even think about. Or people also look at bugs or sea critters. They see different spectra of light than we do. So they're seeing all of these interactions that we're just not seeing. So they probably experience, this is me anthropomorphizing, sorry, Ed Yong. They probably experience home too, but they probably experience it in a whole different spectra than we do. So I think the human experience of home is very unique to us, right? Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, think about how much we are able to travel and experience in a lifetime. I mean, sometimes if you're a tree, you're not moving. You're planted somewhere and you're staying there. We don't do that usually. Some people do. A lot of people in my home in Wisconsin don't really move. They stay in the same state and then they'll continue to have more generations, more family in that same state. There are a lot of people who do that. And I think that that experience of home is both very similar and very different because they're experiencing it changing through time instead of through place.
What's the point of learning about how animals, for example, experience the world? What's the purpose of that knowledge?
I think it's for moral reasons because you think about how you treat an ecosystem or how what sort of things you're doing that don't bother you that could bother another organism so much. A noise that you don't think is very loud causes lots and lots of disruption for like a bug or something. I think it's important for people as people to not be very arrogant and say, oh, we're only here for us and overlook all of these other different amazing organisms and sort of look down on all of these organisms because we think, okay, well, we're the smartest, we're the best. Well, we're the best at the way that we experience best. We're probably not the best. Like, I can't run faster than a gazelle. I can't listen harder than a cat. I can't see all of the ultraviolet light hitting different things. So I think it's a good reality check and a little bit of a good ego check for people sometimes to just think before acting and think before making a giant decision that doesn't seem so giant for people, but is giant for other organisms.
So you think that we should care about animals? In what sense should we care about animals and the ecosystems in general?
I think that we are, the ecological term for us humans is ecosystem engineers. We cause great changes to ecosystems that affect the homes of all of these other different animals. People also call elephants ecosystem engineers because they love knocking down trees because they're hungry or they're mad at them. And they change, they kill a tree, right? And then they change what sort of home is available for other sorts of animals and organisms there. They pat down the soil. That changes what sort of bugs, termites, fungi can live there. We do the same thing. We do clearing. We're very selective with what organisms we want in certain places. We bring other species, we bring invasives, we bring a whole suite of things, not to mention construction. We let out very loud noises, jets, everything. Mm-hmm. So we are ecosystem engineers. I think that we are ecosystem engineers in a different class than elephants, because if one elephant knocks down a tree, okay, yes, an elephant knocked down a tree. That is engineering, but we've done so much to change our ecosystem that I think it's important for us because we can think about it, because that is one of the things that we innately can do. That's one of our skills. Think about how we're affecting other animals and other plants and how what sort of engineering mark we're leaving on the world.
So is the idea that you're expressing that because we have this innate ability, then therefore we're responsible towards the ecosystem?
Yeah, I think so.
And I'm wondering, is there the underlying belief behind that view that animals and ecosystems can indeed experience a sense of home? If there wasn't that belief, then would that not be something that we would bother about?
Yeah, I think that that's a great way to put it. Animals can definitely experience home. A really good example of this actually is something called edge effect, which is an ecological principle where, okay, you have a chunk of forest and then that chunk of forest eventually ends, right? There's an edge to it. Maybe it's edged by a road, maybe by, I don't know, a village or another sort of ecosystem, maybe a savanna. And that border area where you're leaving your home and entering into another home is a very different ecosystem. It's a lot more stressed because it's experiencing all of these different, I don't know, pollution, higher winds. Sometimes people will go in, do things, and it fundamentally changes these edges of an ecosystem into something that is less a home for animals, and animals spend less time. Sometimes, especially if they're very sensitive animals, in these edges, or they don't do very well because they are used to a certain home. They are used to a certain habitat that they live in. And I think that also, I'll talk more about elephants actually, because they have such wonderful memories. They remember home, and they remember also traumatic things related to home. So mother elephants show their children where the good places are, where they should go, where they should eat, where they should mate, what seasons they should go there. And they also sort of, by not bringing their children places or by sort of negative reinforcement, show their offspring where not to go. So when poaching was a really big problem, elephants remembered. An elephant that survives knows, okay, I'm not going to go to this place because I've seen, I don't know, my siblings, my parents murdered there by people. Okay, so I won't go there. So then suddenly a home shift happens where these mother elephants who have survived are showing their kids places that are not locations where poaching has happened because they're still afraid and they still remember. And then their kids, even if their kids never experienced poaching, they won't go there until some rando elephant decides to get lost and rediscover a place. But you have this sort of generational memory, which I think is something that's overlooked a lot in animals and organisms, this generational memory of home and what is not home and what is a lost home. So yeah, that was a really long-winded answer to your question, but I really do think that organisms experience a home.
Mm. I want to go back to the point that you made about humans having certain abilities. The one that you mentioned was, can you say it for us?
Ecosystem engineering.
Ecosystem engineering. And I'm wondering whether these innate abilities give certain species more dominance or more of a priority when it comes to how we should order the world. So does that mean, for example, that humans have dominion, that they're the priority, or how can we think about hierarchy and prioritization and importance in terms of ecosystems and different species?
Yeah. So this is a really good thing to think about, because I think that if you asked most people, they'd say, oh yeah, humans are number one, right? I mean, we care for our species. That's a very organic thing to do. If I were to look at it completely objectively, I'd say, okay, well, we're all equal, right? We're all organisms. We all deserve a place, right? I think that humans don't do that usually, and it's very hard for humans to do that because we care about continuing, we care about improving what we think is improving our world and sort of the experience of our world through our eyes and not through other species' eyes. But I think we're making big steps with that, with conservation, with conserving homes, right? Conserving animals' homes and reevaluating how our homes might or might not affect these other homes. So I think it's really just animals can't have a say, right? Because we speak a different language and we're the ecosystem engineers. We are in charge, right? With our sort of engineering, the way we experience engineering. If you look at it from, I don't know, a virus or a fungus, they don't care. They'll keep on doing their things because we're not the ones who are affecting their stuff, but we're affecting a lot of other stuff. So I think we do have an innate job to help conserve it for the animals that can't speak to other humans, right?
Is the simple fact that we all exist, does that guarantee that we're even, that we're equal?
Yeah, I think so.
The fact of existence. Okay, what makes you think that?
Well, I mean, we all do exist. So, I mean, if we're all organisms, right? Considering living, we all live, right? I think that that should be enough to make us think, okay, well, we're all equal. Everything should be cared for, even if we have caused destruction in the past. Mm-hmm. So it can't care for itself in that way. So I think that we have to take on the responsibility to care for it.
What about in cases such as in New Zealand where pine trees are a problem for the native animals? Mm-hmm. How do you ascertain what to do in cases like that? The moral solution where you have to decide between different plants or animals, etc.
Yeah, that's a really good question to ask. You look at what I would do if you asked my opinion. You would have to look at it in a perspective of, do we want to conserve an ecosystem that was there before we intervened? Do you want to conserve it as that? Or do you want to let it continue doing what it's doing without further intervening?
Mm.
So scientists have run into a lot of problems with trying to get rid of invasive species, actually, and have caused more harm through intervention. An example of this, there was a bird, I'm forgetting the island now, but there was a bird, and sailors found this bird. They came to this very remote island. This bird has no natural defenses. Well, no natural defenses against things that it doesn't know about, because it's been isolated on this island for such a long time. Some of the things it didn't know about include mice. Mice are on ships, so the mice came to the island and absolutely started demolishing the bird population because the birds couldn't fight back. And then scientists said, okay, well, why don't we bring in cats? Because cats eat mice. And why don't we solve the problem and get rid of the mice? Horrible idea, because cats also eat birds. So oftentimes science and scientists get us into a lot of trouble trying to deal with something that they've caused, not scientists, but people have caused, through trying to really intervene and try to fix a problem. I am always in favor of a more hands-off approach that sort of lets an ecosystem handle it. And then if you see an ecosystem really struggling, I personally, if I wasn't going to cause more harm in an ecosystem, I don't know about the pine trees in New Zealand because I know very little about the ecology there, to be honest, but I would try to get rid of the pine trees because that was an intervention that we did, right? I mean, we caused that. And if you think about it from less of a species perspective and more of an ecosystem home perspective, what's the best way to restore a home for the most species? And what happens if you end up losing some really endemic species? I mean, if you look at it from a biodiversity scientist's perspective, you want to keep as many branches on the tree of life as possible, because every branch is so important and it shows such a rich history, and it would be such a pity to lose it.
Mm.
And that's what happens every time another species goes extinct. And it's especially apparent in species where there aren't a lot of twigs on that branch or something. You're cutting off an entire branch. You're stopping years and years of evolution. You're stopping the natural course of time and how things would have happened if we hadn't had such a large effect. This also brings up the question, though, okay, well, we do have a large effect and we're part of the tree of life. So how do you as a scientist grapple with that? And how do you think, okay, well, I can intervene in all of these different ways. I'm around, I'm a branch. What can I do and what is the right thing to do? And honestly, scientists and no one really knows, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a question that everyone has to think about and decide for themselves, and everyone's going to have a different answer.
Is there a lot of moral grayness in the realm of science?
Yes. Like medicine? No, I mean, don't do something to hurt someone, something like that. But I think especially in conservation, there is a lot of moral grayness. I think a wonderful example of this actually is in child nutrition in areas with high poaching. If a child is going to have malnutrition as a result of people completely stopping poaching, that's a horrible thing, right? And we feel that because that's a human, right? And there's a huge amount of moral grayness there because you say, okay, well, this is a protected species, but how is this family going to eat otherwise? And I would lobby, okay, yeah, poach, because you don't want someone to starve and die. there was a class in college called the arrogant ape. This is me being more of an arrogant ape. I care about my species. And that's the way all organisms are hardwired, right? Mm-hmm. You want to care about your people first and then everything else second. So it's an interesting moral grayness on, okay, how do I weigh these things? How do I look at conservation? How do I try to conserve the tree of life and also make these decisions that could be really, really weighty? So conservation biologists, if you go to a conference, it's always crazy. More moral discussion than you would imagine in science. But I think it's a really important discussion to have. A lot of people try to shy away from it because it's hard. But I think it's a really important discussion to have, even if you don't come up with any solution. I mean, sometimes there just is no solution. But you at least have to think about everything and acknowledge everything.
Do they teach you how to think about solving these moral dilemmas? What's the foundation for it?
I took a really wonderful conservation biology class where the professor made sure that everyone was absolutely humbled by asking people some really what you wouldn't think is a hard question. Mm-hmm. And then poking holes in everything, different moral arguments, different moral dilemmas. And everyone was heartbroken and sad and being like, what even is conservation? What is Earth? Am I a good person? Probably not. I think that that was really what shaped my view of conservation and my view of like, okay, yes, step up, acknowledge the gray area and talk about it and see what you think is the best solution for a very specific problem. You can't be making crazy generalizations, especially in conservation, because that's when you're going to run into a lot of trouble.
Is that the main reason why people make bad decisions in conservation, because they're generalizing?
In my opinion, probably yes, but that's also a generalization.
Yeah.
I think that generalizations are sometimes very important to have because otherwise you get nowhere. But at the same time, making decisions off of gross generalizations can cause a lot of harm to ecosystems, to communities even. There are so many people who get caught in the crossfire in really mammoth conservation decisions if people don't go out and actually experience the place that they're going to be doing conservation in, experience the people, experience the landscape. It's like going back to your idea of home. It's like saying, okay, home is everywhere and you don't need to look at a specific home in order to understand home. It really is saying, okay, sometimes conservationists overgeneralize to the entire earth. I view the earth as my home, yes, that's a generalization, but the entire earth, no, I haven't been to the entire earth. How could I view it as a homeland if it's a place that I'm not connected to at all? That my relatives have never been to, I've never read about it, I don't even know about this place, a certain specific place. That is where conservationists have problems, and I think that more and more it's becoming better, though. I think that people are really understanding, okay, overgeneralizations can be bad, but they can also be good, and it's important to just be very wary when you use them.
With what you said about home and your connection to these generalizations that scientists can make when they haven't actually been to homelands, do you think that there's an error in people saying that home is everything, even though they haven't been to those places?
Maybe. It's difficult because sometimes if you look at family history-wise, I mean, think about us, right? There are places that our grandparents have been and lived that we would consider, okay, well, that's where my family is from. That's our homeland, but we've never been there, right?
Yeah.
I think that's different, though, because we're connected to it. If someone is like, ah, yes, my home is in this place that I've never been, that I have no connection to, you say, okay, great, it could be, but you should go there and you should experience it and see if it really is your home before it's your home. The other interesting thing to think about is, all right, maybe this person does know a lot about this place. I mean, they've read about it in books. They know this is the perfect place for me. This is my home. I don't think that that should be scoffed at. I feel like that's a valid thing. But if you plot me in a place that I've never heard of and never read of and have no connection to, I wouldn't view that as my home. I don't know about you.
I think I could definitely have a general idea of home for sure.
Mm-hmm.
At least in my perspective, I see everything as a gift from God and everything as my home because the spirit lives in me. And therefore, everywhere I go, I know that God is with me and God is my home.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I conceive of it.
Well, that's a wonderful point.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, as someone who's done so much thinking around the climate, the environment, science, what's your personal relationship to nature or creation like? And how is creation maybe home for you, or maybe it's not a home for you? I don't want to assume.
Yeah. I mean, nature is such a special thing for me. And I think it's definitely where I feel most at home. I was in Yerevan originally before moving here to the wonderful place of Gyumri, and that did not feel like home to me. I had to go so far to see more than a few trees. You couldn't see the biodiversity. I mean, there were so many wonderful people and wonderful things there, but it was half home for me. I lived there, yes, and I lived there for a while, but I consider Gyumri much more of a home than I consider Yerevan because of the nature, because of the easy access to nature. I think that nature is such a magical thing. I really don't know what I would do without it. I think it's a place where I can go to think and where I can kind of see mirrors to my own personal relationships, to my own life. You see ecosystems and you see personal connections. You see all of these things. And also ecosystems are so unique. I mean, the Armenian ecosystem is so multifaceted. I mean, there are so many different places. There are so many different trees and organisms. Each of them is very special and their home is Armenia and their home is the specific place and specific ecosystem they are in Armenia. And I love discovering that because you see so many different homes in such a small place. And similarly, I think, you know, if you put me in a place and you just showed me the nature, I'd be like, okay, this is this sort of place. If you put me in the Midwest, it's definitely a degraded form of an ecosystem that used to be there. I mean, it's farmland, but you can still see it as the ecosystem it is. You see, oh, yeah, this is a sort of home for me. Same thing. I spent many, many summers in the Republic of Congo, and even if I just hear all of the bugs and the birds, I'm like, oh, yeah, I feel like I'm back there. And it's a wonderful way to surround yourself with memories, too. I mean, you go back and you sit in an ecosystem for a while, and you feel like you're 6 or you're 15 and you're in a certain place with certain people doing things that you have not done in a long time in a memory. I think that that memory is really special.
Do you think that your relationship with nature would be more heightened because you have so much knowledge about ecosystems? How is it different to someone like me?
I mean, yes and no. I think I definitely look at nature with a very scientific lens sometimes, but other times I'm like, yeah, no, I don't feel like doing that today. I just want to enjoy. I mean, everyone can enjoy the beautiful views. If you consider yourself a nature lover, if you feel happy in nature, then I think that that's all you need. I think that scientists do a lot of gatekeeping, and I think that they should do less of that to make more people care about ecosystems, about nature. You don't need to know the specific species that you're seeing to enjoy it and say, wow, that's a really pretty frog. That's a really pretty bird. That's an Armenian bird. I know that because I saw it in Armenia. I mean, everyone is a scientist in that way.
Do you like to be by yourself when you're in nature?
Yes and no. If I'm with someone who I absolutely don't know, I like to get a little bit of space. But if I'm with friends, if I'm with family, I love that. I love being in nature with others too. But there are certain things that you can only see when you're by yourself. I mean, if you just let the quiet of an ecosystem wash over you in a way that people in a group could never do, it's a really magical thing. You sort of pay attention to things, you see things, you hear things that you wouldn't have otherwise.
In that moment, does it feel like a sense of home washes over you?
I think so, yeah. It's a very meditative place for me, as I'm sure it is for so many people.
Meditative in what way? Like a perfect alignment, almost?
Yeah, I feel very peaceful.
Yeah.
But it doesn't always have to be happy either. I mean, you can see degraded things. You can see history in a way that can sometimes be painful, but it's a sort of at peace pain. You look at it and you say, okay, well, this has happened, but I'm experiencing it now and I'm seeing all of these things and hearing all of these things. And I think the only way I could describe it is meditative. I lose track of time when I'm in nature in a way that I think I don't in other places.
Is it always meditative for you? Because I've had so many instances where I've wanted to connect with nature, but I feel this disconnection. And I feel moody and like I'm just sitting there getting nowhere. And I just want to return to a house or...
Get me my hot shower.
Yeah. Do you experience that as well, a disconnection, when you want to feel connected in really amazing moments where you feel like this should amount to something, but you just get nowhere?
I do understand that. So when I was in the Republic of Congo, we camped for months, and it was not the most comfortable thing in the world. You were swarmed by bugs. I was almost attacked by a hyena once. Like, no. I definitely did not feel calm in those moments. But I think that the longer time I spent out there, the more I sort of was able to breathe, move on. I think that that's sort of the lesson that nature taught me, how to kind of move on and just let things wash over you, let things happen. Okay, yeah, those mosquitoes, they were bad. But now look, I'm seeing all of these monkeys playing in the trees. Yes, I have bug bites. Yes, that sucks. But it's okay. It kind of gives you like almost a Buddhist sort of sense of, okay, yeah, that was pain, that was suffering. But now I can move past that. I can acknowledge that and then see this is not Buddhist, all of the really good things. I know all life is pain, but that's why I'm not completely Buddhist. I do acknowledge that. It's a very interesting experience. And I think that it applies to not just nature, though. I mean, it applies to so many other things. Sometimes you feel like you should be taking something from an experience that has meant a lot to someone else, right?
Yeah.
Like someone is like, oh, you have to do this. It was so great for me. And then you feel nothing. I think that it's a very specific to a person thing sometimes. Maybe I feel most at peace in nature. You don't have to, and you can find that somewhere else. Maybe that's a sort of differing homeland thing, but everyone, hey, we're back at generalization. everyone does feel that with something though, right? Mm.
Even the thing that we feel that with, it could easily change based on your own feelings. Feelings are so flighty. So I think that the most important thing is your open-hearted gratitude. I find when I'm in nature and I feel completely numbed, it doesn't matter so much to me as compared to the gratitude that I can even force.
Yeah.
You don't always want to feel grateful. You don't always want to feel blissful. And it's not always going to just happen to you. I think you have to create that as well and be intentional.
It is a big mindset thing.
Yeah.
I try to be a very positive person usually. And when I first arrived in the Republic of Congo, I didn't realize that I wasn't going to be taking a hot shower for 3 months. and that was the maddest I think I'd ever been. I was bug bitten. I was sad. I was wet. It was hot. I was so mad. And I did not enjoy anything for days. I was like, this sucks. I have to do work all day. I'm an introvert. And I was with people and we couldn't leave the other people because otherwise there were animal encounter difficulties. Like you could have been face to face with an elephant or a hyena or something and no one would be around to help you. I was just so mad. I was like, I'm stuck with these five people. I'm bug bitten. I'm sad. I'm in a tent. There is no bathroom. Mom, take me home. And then something happened. Like, I wallowed. People did not know that I was wallowing because I was like, man, they're going to think I'm a baby. But I was wallowing. I was so mad. And I was like, what? Why did I do this? Why? Yeah. And I think we saw crocodiles that day. We saw all of these wonderful trees. We saw just so many amazing birds. I did not care. I was done. I was like, that doesn't matter because I'm uncomfy and I'm sad and I want to go home. Once I got past that, it was something actually one of the more experienced people said to me. He was like, yeah, you know, when you're in the jungle, things change. You have to sort of experience a mindset change and you're going to have a break. You're going to just be really mad for like a week sometimes. And you just have to honor it and you have to let it happen. And then move past it and then be grateful, like you said. Be grateful for all of the things you're seeing and all of the work that you get to do. And sort of also think about why you're here and what brought you here. And at the time I was like, come on, I'm stuck with you. I have to listen to you talk for 24 hours a day. I'm camping with you. Shh. But then I realized that he was really right. Those people ended up becoming some of my best friends because I was eternally grateful to them, and I was so grateful for their presence and for all of their wise words, even if sometimes I wasn't ready to receive them. Just like all of the wonderful gifts that nature let me see, I was able to see so many cool things. I look back on that week where I was just mad at the world, and I say, wow, think about all of the cool nature I saw. Think about all of the wonderful work I was able to accomplish. So I think sometimes it's a retrospect thing, and then also after I had my sort of... It was my culture shock week. After that, I was like, oh, wow, yeah, you know, this is actually pretty great. So I don't know. I don't know what that rambling meant, but I think it sort of was that you have to sit with something for a while sometimes to get the right mindset. And then once you have the right mindset, it's hard not to enjoy something.
And when you sit with it, you think, give yourself free vent, be as sulky as you want, as moody as you want.
Let it out. I mean, what are you going to do if you just keep something in? There's no way for it to escape. I think you just have to write it out, let it out, run it out, do something to kind of get it out of there, let it have its space, and then move on.
I think it's good to release it, but to release it in a way that you're not just taking it out on everyone around you constantly. Because if you allow yourself to be sulky to everyone, then it's just not pleasant and
no,
it's not fair.
I completely agree.
Yeah.
And also, you've got to cut off the wallowing at some point. You have to sit with your feelings. I feel like everyone has experienced this. It's an interesting balance between sitting and acknowledging with your feelings and also moving on.
And I wanted to know if you've had a similar experience in Armenia. You said that you were homesick.
Yes.
For the first stretch. Mm-hmm. Was it a similar thing where you were unable to appreciate fully the fact that you're in Armenia mm-hmm. and all of the amazing opportunities and sights around you? Did that take a while?
It took some time. When I got homesick, actually, was when my parents visited me. So my boyfriend had visited me for my birthday, and then my parents visited me right afterwards. And it was a wonderful time. I was surrounded by so many people that loved me and knew me very well, and I showed them so many cool things. I was like, yes, let me take you around Armenia, because I've been here a bit now. And then they left, and I was like, wow, they're going home, and I'm here, and I'm going to be here for so much more time. So that was the start of my homesickness. And then the way that I often view homesickness and bad feelings is also with a physical manifestation. Often when I'm not feeling my best physically, I also don't feel my best emotionally. I went with Birthright to Mehri, which was an amazing time. It was fantastic. I am vegetarian, so I ate something that was kind of questionable on the drive back and had the worst food poisoning of my life. And I was just sitting on my own for days, throwing up, thinking about my parents and my boyfriend and their cozy, wonderful home, and it just all hit me. I wasn't having an enjoyable time to begin with, but then I was like, you know, this is horrible, this is the worst, why am I here? And that stayed for about a week. It stayed a few days after I got better, and I mean, I don't think that I let it out on other people, but I wrote about it, and writing about it was my sort of way of letting it all out. And after that, I felt great. But I had to stick with that. I had to let it happen. Mm. And I had to let myself be a little bit miserable for a day or two before I was able to move on. And then I was like, all right, Beatrice, it's time. It's time to move on. It's time to unhomesickify. And that did the trick. And I haven't been homesick since. I don't know about you, but when I move to a new place, it gets me for like a week.
Me too. It's always the start. I noticed that with myself too. And I really have to be intentional about not taking it out on others. The mm-hmm. easy thing to do is to get really moody.
Yes.
And so caught up in your emotions that you end up not being nice and then regretting it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good that I'm aware of that now, the pattern that the first week is hard.
Yes. It's always the first week.
Is it first week for you too?
It's usually first or second week, depending on how jarring the change is. If it's really jarring first week, I'm like, this is such a change. I think it's really good to understand that, though. And also, it's the growing pains, right, of getting a new home.
Yes. And trying to work out the dynamics of the new home.
Mm-hmm. Home is both good and bad, right? Home isn't just this, like, absolute paradise, utopian place. Home has problems. Home has issues. So I think it's you figuring out, at least it was for me, figuring out the problems and issues. And sort of learning the new home. And if you get through that, you're not a tourist, you're not just in this rose-colored glasses phase, you get past that, you get a real home.
That's such an important insight, because I think we can make such an ideal out of home and make it into this perfect place. And even with nostalgia, we can elevate our past to a very high degree that it's not actually based on any kind of truth. It's just rose-colored. And we seek to return to this original falsified idea of home, and then we're never happy with where the future leads us because it's just not the same as what we grew up with. But it's true, even the very first home that we can think of, it's very imperfect. I think nothing is going to reach a state of perfection on earth.
No,
that's so needed. I feel like I'm even buying into this ideal of home, but it's not actually based on reality.
And oftentimes, what is it called, the Paris effect?
The Paris effect.
You know, people go to Paris and they hear all of this ideal stuff. Oh, the place of love. It's the best. One must go to Paris. And then they go to Paris and they see flaws with Paris and then they get so sad. It's kind of the Paris effect of homeland.
Yes, that's true. Yeah.
It's very interesting. It's almost like I would be surprised if any home I get, I don't feel that.
Wow. That's such an interesting perspective. We almost think the opposite. Like we're entitled to a perfect sense of home, but nothing is perfect.
Yeah.
And it's always going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think we have to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Maybe we'll end it there. That's just such food for thought.
Yes.
I could talk to you forever, so we should probably end it at some point.
Well, that's a good thing to end on. How did we get here?